the U.S. Congress never really passed the budget for this year. And that's just one of the unusual issues our delegation is contending with. Good morning, welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Our guest today is Senator Mark Begich, and we also have a studio audience. But we welcome your calls from around the state at 1-800-478-8255, as always, 478-TALK. In Anchorage, a local call of 550-8422, email talk at aprn.org. Senator Mark Begich is ready to take your input today on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, I'd really like to say welcome to our studio audience here coming out for Senator Mark Begich and participating in this experiment. Senator, thank you very much, and welcome to Talk of Alaska. How are you doing?
Very good, thank you. And I think this is a great idea, having the studio audience here. And it's an experiment, and we'll make it work.
We will make it work.
But it's great to be back home. And of course, when you leave Washington at 90 degree weather and about 90% humidity, coming back here is a breath of fresh air, and it's been great already.
96 today.
What it will be too?
96.
96. Well, I'm glad I'm here. And
it'll be hot when you get back. Don't worry.
Yeah, and it won't be hot outside. It'll be hot inside
yeah.
for a lot of reasons.
Right. So you managed to get out to Bethel with the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, yes?
Absolutely. The Secretary's here. He's visiting Alaska. Obviously going to the VA facilities, but really we gave him an invitation. We said you need to come to Alaska, but not just to the urban area, Anchorage or Fairbanks or Juneau, but go out to a hub like Bethel and then go out to a village, which we went to Quigg yesterday in Bethel. And he had a chance to sit down with some veterans, but also in Quigg he had a chance to see one of the clinics because we think there's an opportunity to maybe partner between the VA and Indian Health Services in delivering care to our veterans out in rural Alaska through our tribal consortium that delivers health care. But the really probably moving and emotional part of that trip was when we were out giving certificates, and the secretary had a special coin and I had a coin that give to the Alaska Territorial Guard members. We had a special ceremony in Quigg. There was quite a few that were there. And just to have the elders receiving this recognition of their service to their country, to their state, to a group of people that I think were forgotten for many years. And having, when you think about the Secretary of the Veterans Administration on Memorial Day, could be anywhere in the country. But this year he was here and in a small village called Quigg, and gave him a chance to really experience. The best part, I have to say, along with the ceremony, was looking on the face of the secretary as we arrived at the airport, as we call them. I think he had a different view of it, but then he had to get on a four-wheeler to be, the convoy came out to meet us, and he was on the back of a piece of plywood on the back end of a four-wheeler, and I think it was just watching him. Here's the the president's man who deals with the Veterans Administration, 22 million veterans, and here we had him on the back of a four-wheeler driving down a boardwalk headed to a small community hall meeting. So it was a great experience to see, but also to see the village come out and then recognize the Territorial Guard members and with a special recognition.
I remember when you you speaking of your relationship with the the administration, and I'm thinking about you came up to Fort Greeley with Secretary Gates.
That's
and shortly
right.
After that, we got the announcement that they're going to keep the Greeley expansion on the timetable.
That's right.
And now Gates is gone. How are you getting along with the military side of the Obama administration?
Actually, very well. We I just met with the designee, Mr. Panetta, who great conversation. And very excited. We talked about, we want to reassure them. I think he is going to be just as robust supporting Alaska in the military support. Because that trip we took with Secretary Gates was very important. You know, as you said, it made sure he saw the missile defense system, how important that was. But since that time, we now have investment going to Clear Air Force Base, updating and upgrading that whole system there. And now Fort Greeley, again, is getting additional upgrades. all that connected is probably $400 or $500 million over the next several years of expenditure by the federal government, which is important because it's huge jobs, a lot of other things. The designee will be in front of us, I'm assuming, over the next couple weeks for confirmation, and we've already had a meeting to kind of make sure he knew what kind of questions I'm going to be asking, specifically around Alaska issues. And he's well-versed, and I believe clearly understands that we talked about missile defense. We talked about 8A corporations because they do a lot of business with the Defense Department. We talked about personnel issues because as when January hits this next year, we will have, between January and May, almost 9,000 Alaska troops in Afghanistan. We will be probably the largest contingency of one state, pretty significant. And we want to make sure that the new defense secretary understands that we have critical needs and services here for the families that will not have their spouses with them because they will be overseas for long periods of time. So we gave him kind of what I call the Alaska education before we had the hearing. So he's well versed, and so hopefully on the record he'll say the right things and we'll encourage him to do so. But these are just a couple of secretaries. As you know, we've brought up, I think we're now maybe 8 different secretaries we've brought up.
Salazar has been several times.
Salazar, we've brought up to education, ag, energy, HUD, you know, all these guys. And we try to bring them, as you know, to not only, again, urban areas, hubs, but villages. So when they walk away, they get a way better picture. And I can tell you when we brought the crew up the very first time before Salazar, around just after Salazar, we ended up now, we have a lot of money going into Western Alaska for internet connectivity, fiber being laid, which will connect, I think, around 50, 60 villages up to fiber optics, which is unbelievable when you think about the technology that it can deliver. But, you know, they had to see it. And I remember sitting there with the Secretary of Ag, and we were looking, agriculture, and we were looking at the new school, I think it was in Hoover Bay, and he said, a beautiful school, and he saw the room, and he says, we should, you know, get all the computers hooked up, and it'd be great. And I said, that'd be great if we had high-speed broadband, mm-hmm. but we can't do that, and we got to watch our capacity. That was an awakening, because, you know, they see the computers, and they think, oh, you just plug and play like they do in the lower 48. It's much different here.
Yeah. Well, I know you're, you know, before the listeners get to it, we're with Senator Mark Begich, our telephone number, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. In Anchorage, a local call at 550-8422, email talk at APRN.org. Senator, you're on the Commerce Committee, mm-hmm. and I am assuming that there will be a call, and I'm just going to get in there ahead of them, on a perennial issue, and probably going to come back again, and something that Senator Ted Stevens had strong feelings on, which is net neutrality. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Do you have a position?
Well, I support net neutrality. I like to call it internet freedom. Some people, you know, when you say net neutrality, people say, what is that exactly? Well, simply to ensure that people have access to the net without economic burdens or economic barriers. And I think it's important. This will be a hot issue. And you're right. It's interesting. If you had asked me this 4 or 5 months ago in the Commerce Committee, telecom, internet issues, those were not really on the burner. They were like, you know, we're not going to do much with that. Well, it's all starting to heat up because we have some. Now the economy is getting better. You have these telecom companies starting to merge and communication companies. So a lot of that's now spinning out there. Now you have access issues. You have privacy issues. You have security on the internet, cyber warfare. I mean, all this is now like merged in the last probably 3 or 4 months. And so now you're going to see probably over the next, I would venture to guess as we move out of the summer into the fall, this will be some hot issues. And it's, when you think about internet, you know, cyber warfare, cyber security, privacy issues, we took on, you know, a big issue around Facebook and how they were sharing information that people had on there, and they mm-hmm. had no knowledge that was happening, and we wanted them to switch their way of doing it, that you could opt out. So these are all now starting to really heat up, and obviously net neutrality is going to be a big piece of it, because the power of innovation, at least from my perspective, what's really moved our economy, in you think of the last 10 years, it's what the internet has been able to do to share ideas, or people in very remote areas who have some great ideas, economic ideas, business ideas, and they're able to use the internet to share that with the rest of the world. That's a powerful tool, and we got to be careful that we do not strangle it, and the net result could be we stifle our economic growth. The other is the whole issue of spectrum. That will be another issue. You know, we have public safety folks that need more space on the spectrum. I'm learning more about spectrum than I ever thought I would ever want to know. But the big issue is, simply put, as we create a stronger public safety network, so fire can talk to police, police can talk to the troopers, troopers can talk to the marshals, that takes a network that has to have a certain amount of space on the spectrum. But of course, that spectrum is very valuable, and commercial interests want to grab it and hold it. But you know, we have an obligation to ensure that we have the best public safety ability to communicate. And think about what's going on down in the lower 48 with the tornadoes and the activity now going on there. The communication is critical. Without it, we're going to be in trouble.
Yeah. Well, I don't see any calls at the moment on our monitor. And
you know how that always works. It always is that last 20 minutes. They all start calling in, and then
they
were booked solid.
Totally. No, I was just trying to prompt them to get the monitor working there. But I would like, perhaps there's someone in the studio audience that would like to step to a microphone with a question or some input for Senator Mark Begich. Would you identify yourself, please?
Yes. Welcome, Senator Begich. Glad you could be here today. My name's Joshua Wilson. I'm with Commonwealth North. Mm-hmm. Question very highlighted now with the high cost of fuel, but almost 90% of the state's income comes from revenue generated from oil production. As production in Alaska continues to decline, now under 600,000 barrels, what can be done at a national level to increase Alaska's oil production and then in hand decrease America's dependence on foreign oil?
Well, what a softball.
Yeah, that's, it's interesting. That is the, everywhere I go, energy. If it's not the person filling, you know, I sometimes dread now when I go over, get my car filled, fill up with gas, or go into the convenience store and I walk out and someone's pumping their fuel and they see me, there's usually a moment that they put it on the automatic, you know, and then they kind of look over and I can feel them coming. And, you know, so you have to be ready to kind of have that discussion. But energy is a big issue. And Alaska is in the position, in my view, to be a critical piece of whatever energy policy we have in this country, which right now we have none. It's somewhat embarrassing. Actually, a couple days ago, a Saudi prince made the comment, and it was actually an incredible article. I clipped it. I'm saving it. I'm taking it back to Washington, as this is the worst kind of energy policy we could ever have. And that was, the Saudi prince made the comment that we got to keep America, the United States, hooked on our oil. Now, if that is something that doesn't wake us up, and there's a reason, obviously, why they want us hooked on their oil for a variety of international issues, economic issues, Alaska plays an integral part. We are very fortunate we have a significant amount of oil and gas, but we also have enormous amounts of renewable energy in this state. But first on oil and gas, I think it's a two-prong approach. One, the state has a huge opportunity with some of their own existing lands, especially around heavy oil, which right now at the price we're at per barrel, there is a effort by the industry to encourage the state to create some incentives around heavy oil, because there's billions of barrels of heavy oil available. It takes a different kind of technology, but the state has to step up to the plate and do something. You know, they spent all this session talking about other issues around taxes, and then they went on for another 30 days on coastal zone management and some other things. This issue on heavy oil is actually, most people agree, yeah, we should have some incentives to move the state oil. So the state has to, you know, honestly step up to the plate on that end. On the federal end, when I came in the office, we changed the approach of how we wanted to deal with this. The approach that we've had for 40 years is ANWR, which I'm a big supporter of ANWR. I support the oil development of ANWR, but all we did was talk about ANWR, and we got nothing for it in 40 years. Now, we can argue there was times when we were on the edge of getting something, but the point is, we got nothing.
We're still talking about it,
and we still have nothing. Now, the approach we've taken since I came in the office is ANWR, National Petroleum Reserve, Beaufort, Chukchi, all four in play at the same time. Because the more you have out there in motion, the more activity, the more the greater potential of hitting one of those and some movement. I do believe, and I'll say it here, I say it everywhere I go, that by next year, end of next year, I believe we'll be exploring or developing in MPRA or Chukchi or both. Because everything's moving. Now, there's got to be patient, and there's a lot of struggles and a lot of legal issues and so forth, but I feel on both of those we're moving in the right direction. I think we'll resolve some issues with MPRA, what they call CD5. It's a bridge issue. Very, you know, if you ask all the engineers, there's lots of technical reasons, certain ways we need to access that area. But I do believe, based on conversations as recently as last Friday that I had in the White House, I went over to the White House to talk about energy issues, that I believe those two have the greatest potential. And they will be billions of barrels that we can utilize to fill up the oil pipeline. But on top of that, I will say one more thing. If we develop Chukchi and Beaufort, either one of those, that we have to make sure there's revenue sharing. Revenue sharing for the state of Alaska. Louisiana has it. We should have it. And any other coastal state in this country, if they develop off their shores in federal waters, a portion of that should come back to the state that's affected, because we have resources we have to spend and utilize. So I think we're...
But what if it comes through the coastal policy system?
Well, I just sent a letter to the governor last week, and their inaction on the coastal zone management has put oil exploration in the Arctic at risk. And here's why that's the case. In order to do oil exploration up in the Arctic, maybe Beaufort or Chukchi, you have to have a port, a deep water port, in order to service the oil spill technology vessels that will be up there and the exploration vessels, so forth. Otherwise, it's all in Dutch Harbor, and we can't afford it. It has to be right there. Well, you cannot do a deep water port in state waters because it's too shallow. You know, people forget that's at the top of the world, so the water is very shallow. It's not down like in the Gulf where you can go down 5,000 feet. In some cases, you're drilling maybe 70 feet only. So you have to have a deep water port. Well, the only way you can do a deep water port is you have to have it in federal waters. Well, under the federal law, you can't put a deep water port in federal waters that deals with oil and gas unless the adjacent state has a coastal zone management plan. Now, I don't know what politics are going on in Juneau and what the governor was up to and these other guys, but they have now put at great risk the ability to do development in the Arctic, because without that port, we cannot do the future development at the level we need. And I don't think I don't think they knew, Steve. I can tell you, when I sent the letter, we just did it Tuesday, we got response back from several people who said, well, this is new information. Well, it's not new information. This has been in the federal law. So for them not to understand that has put oil and gas exploration, what we have been working on for 2.5 years, moving everything forward, the state now has dropped kind of a grenade into the process and said, you know, we're not going to do a coastal zone management plan office anymore. Well, without that, you can't do a deep water port. Without a deep water port, you can't service the oil and gas industry.
I want to probe the energy issue just a little bit more.
Sure.
Because it, just before you left, you did cast a vote against revoking some of the tax breaks
Yes.
the oil industry is getting.
Yes.
Why did you do that?
Well, my policy on tax issues, first off, you know, there's two votes. There was that one, and there was a vote on an oil and gas plan that the Republicans have put forward. I voted both on no. I voted no on both of those. And the reason I did, because it was just show and tell. All that was about, okay, we're going to raise our flag, show a certain group of people we're for this, another group for that. On the oil and gas taxes, we have proposed a much more comprehensive approach. It's on my website. It's a bipartisan tax reform legislation that deals with all corporate loopholes, not just one industry. This was because I can show you the pharmaceutical industry. I can show you the insurance industry. GE, they didn't pay one dime, not one penny, in federal taxes last year, but made enormous amounts of profits. You didn't hear anybody putting a piece of legislation down on that one. And so my view was, let's get done with the show and tell, these political games that are going on, and get focused on the real issue. Energy policy, a real one, and tax reform. In my tax reform that we've laid out, it's myself, Senator Wyden from Oregon, and Senator Coates, Democrat, Republican. It deals with some of these incentives. It lowers them. But we also lower many other incentives that other corporations are receiving that are using them to ship jobs overseas or avoid their obligations here. That's the right way to do it. And people are fed up, in my view, of this games that go. We spent a week and a half debating something everyone knew would not pass.
Yeah.
And the American people, Alaskans, are fed up with that. So my approach is, look, do I believe there should be some fairness in the tax system? Absolutely. That's why we've proposed the tax reform we did. It lowers the corporate rate overall, but gets rid of a lot of these loopholes. So it's clear and concise. So when you pay your taxes as a company, you're paying your taxes, not figuring out how not to pay your taxes. And I think that's the approach I prefer to take. And also, this state is highly dependent on oil and gas industry and development. And I think some people were not sensitive to how that could affect us here. But the real issue was, if we're going to do tax issues, let's do a broad approach. If we're going to do an energy policy, like the Republicans put down, let's do one that actually is going to pass, not one just because you want to raise the flag and beat some people up.
Senator Bigich, I got all kinds of questions, but they're coming in by telephone. I could stay on energy for the whole show.
So could I.
There's so many.
We can do just one on energy one of these days.
So many branches, yeah. But
we didn't even talk about renewable energy, alternative energy. There's so much going on there.
Let's go to Kathy, joins the program from Wasilla. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Kathy.
Hi, good morning. I'm a Siri shareholder, and I'm getting pretty fed up with some of the stories I'm hearing from people that are afraid to come forward with complaints about Siri because they either work for Siri or South Central. You know, why was our vote given up? You know, we're free to vote for elections on our board of directors, but we have no vote on any other decisions. Like a normal corporation, why and when was our vote given up by this, you know, state security hierarchy, you know?
Well,
and how do we get our vote back so that it counts on maybe giving them, saying no to their high bonuses that the Siri board experiences? You know, I want that change. You know, they tell us repeatedly this isn't an entitlement program, and yet my people are living in poverty, you know, other than the ones that are getting a college education. And why, when we're worth so much money on paper, are people living in poverty still?
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Kathy. I'm not sure I can answer totally except to say this, that under the Securities and Exchange laws, the corporation sets up its bylaws. They set up the way they elect their board of directors. Then it's overseen not only by the federal securities, but also by the state, really runs a big piece of this. In the board of directors, and Siri has gone through changes over time. A lot of the native corporations where members have participated in electing board members they want to see on the board, or getting rid of board members they don't want on the board. I mean, Siri's gone through that several times in order for the membership to decide what role they want the board to play. So for Kathy, I mean, the advice I'd give her, I know Siri has regular board meetings. That's when you got to participate. They have elections of board of directors. If, you know, people like yourself and others, if they're interested, they got to step up to the plate. And that's how the rules are changed. It's no different than if you were, like in Wasilla, they have co-ops out there running the telephone and electrical. Same thing.
Go ahead, Kathy.
I don't ever remember giving up my 100 shares of votes to Siri.
Well,
I don't ever remember that process. You know, so how we can vote for board members, but we're not like any other corporation. We can't vote on anything else. It's only taken under advisement, and that's wrong.
All right. I think you've given a good hearing to your issue, and I do think that there's more to be said on this because AFN and AITC both want to approach Congress with some ideas for amending the Alaska Native
Land Claims Act.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And that's coming, but it's up the pike a ways.
Right.
Thank you very much for that call, Kathy.
I want to thank you for letting me speak my mind.
Thank you, Kathy.
Thank you very much. And now let's go down to Petersburg, and I can't quite make it out. Looks like, tell me, who are you in Petersburg? Hi, John.
John,
you're on the air.
Thank you very much. Hi,
yes.
Senator Bigich. Thank you for letting me be on the air here. My question was just asked by the moderator a few minutes ago, and it was about the yes vote on $200 billion tax cuts for the oil industry over 10 years. And since you answered your question, I thought I'd just take a moment to give a response, if I might. The question...
I heard a raven responding, too, there.
I believe that comprehensive tax reform, I don't think it's going to happen. Oh, how many years will it ever happen? And action was needed now. We have the U.S. has severe financial problems, and $200 billion in lost revenues is quite serious. It also could have been a symbolic vote to send a message to everyone that we're going to take a stand. for the good of the country. That's what I wanted to say. Thank you.
Well, thanks, John. Thanks. Let me first correct one data point there. It's $22 billion over 10 years. Now, still $22 billion is a lot of money, but it's not $200 billion over 10 years. Second, we do a lot of symbolic votes that get us nowhere. And again, you know, someone who's been a former mayor, you know, I could have spent a lot of time doing symbolic things, but I would have been run out of office probably in the first week. And because people require and demand action on issues. And on tax reform, you know, one thing I've noticed in legislative bodies, and I sympathize with John's frustration, because we have a $14+ trillion debt. We can blame it on Democrats or Republicans or Bush or Obama. It's really irrelevant. It is what it is, and we have to deal with it, and we have to be responsible about it and figure out what the long-term plan is. Is it a 10-year plan, 12-year plan, 15-year plan? It's going to be a long plan to get out of this hole we're in. But to just do symbolic votes, we don't get there. And what Congress, what I've learned in the last 2.5 years, they'd rather take the symbolic votes and do nothing because it's safer. Well, we've done that, and people are fed up with it. What they want now more than ever is figure out some answers, get some things done, and move us in the right track economically. The last 2 years, we've moved and made some tough calls in the economy, and things are a lot better because of some of the calls we've made. But now we have to focus on the long-term budget and spending. The other thing I'd say to John is, one thing I've also noticed about Washington, D.C. is that the attitude is, well, we can't do this, we can't do that. You know, my view in life is much more positive. If you have that attitude, I guarantee you, nothing will get done. You have to have a positive attitude about moving stuff forward. There's a new group of us that came in 2008 that have an attitude of, we're just going to keep pushing the envelope. I mean, if you and I were sitting here 2 years ago having this conversation, which we probably were in another room.
Actually, we were.
We were. And if you said to me, geez, Mark, would you ever have a chance to be in the leadership position of the U.S. Senate? Would you be in the fifth position? Would you be the chair of the Oceans Committee, which is important to Alaska? I would tell you no, because the process takes long. But a lot of us came in there and have been shaking the trees. And we're changing it to say, look, we can keep talking or we can get on with action. So I would say to John, be more optimistic. Tax reform has to happen, because you can't do a long-term budget plan without tax reform as part of the equation. Because the only way you incentivize growth in this country is ensure the right kind of tax incentives are there for growth. For example, we allow people to ship their jobs overseas, and we give them a tax credit to do that. We say, thank you very much for shipping that overseas for the next 10 years. We'll give out over $120 billion of these tax cuts. Makes no sense. Instead, for example, a company I talked to recently, a large company from Alaska, is moving an operation back from China back to the United States because it's a better place to do business. Wage rates have gone up, energy costs, a variety of other reasons. That's the kind of company we want to keep here. We want to bring back. But our tax codes do not really create that opportunity. So I understand John's frustration. I mean, I could take symbolic votes every single day. But I want to get something done. And I think tax reform is critical. The president's now talking about it. The Republicans are talking about it. The Democrats are talking about it. The Senate's talking about it. The House is talking about it. If we had this conversation a year ago, tax reform wasn't even on the list.
Senator Biggert, you earlier mentioned that when you, you're back in Alaska, you're filling your gas tank and people are recognizing you and giving you a certain look.
Right.
What can be done?
Yeah.
I think probably this is the number one issue that has got people really worried and nervous, because
that's
the price
right.
of fuel, motor fuel, has taken a huge chunk out of household budgets. People are having to not do other things now because they have to still make their commute or whatever.
There's a couple things. First, short term, you know, we've introduced a piece of legislation. It's called FAST Act. The idea of the FAST Act is you could put money aside out of your paycheck into a tax-free account and then buy your fuel. Now, why is that important? It's very similar to a medical savings account. Why is that important? Because you can take then on a $4 gallon of gas, we'll use that as the easy mark to negotiate from. If you are an average taxpayer, you will save about 80 cents a gallon. So that $4 gallon will cost you $3.20. Now, that's an immediate savings. That's a piece of legislation we've laid on the table and only would be valid for 2 years. But the goal is to get us through this high cost time. That's an immediate thing you can do. Second, obviously, anybody can spend the time to conserve and do everything that you can. But we also have, not to get heavy in the energy again, but just to be very brief on it, we have to set an energy policy in this country that recognizes that we're going to have energy resources that are going to be diverse across the spectrum, meaning oil and gas to renewable alternative across the spectrum, and do everything we can to accelerate that. Here's two things. When you think of solar energy, and right now when the new panels were, it's kind of a film actually, not a hard panel, was the technology was being developed. The United States developed this technology. 4 years ago, China was producing about 5% of the solar panels in this world. Today, they're about 60%. A technology we invented, but we did not have a policy to incentivize companies to do that development here in the United States. And when you take one after another like that, we have great opportunity, but that takes investment and time. We have wasted and frittered away so much time over the last two, three decades doing what some in Congress would call energy policy. They never did energy policy. Because if you think about the crash in 74, when prices went way up, when Saudi Arabia decided to turn the spigot off, prices went up. We were importing about 35% of our oil around that time from foreign countries. Now we're over 60%. So whatever Congress has done on energy policy hasn't worked worth a darn. All it's gotten us is more foreign oil from countries that don't like us. So
well,
we
seems
have to
like
reverse
whenever,
that.
Whenever it goes up, whenever crude prices go up, refined product prices go up. But
right.
what gets people is when crude prices go back down, refined products prices don't
they,
go
they
down.
They stay like this or
yeah.
they dip a little.
Yeah.
Well, part another thing we've done, we are on the FTC and the Commodities Trade Commission, also CTC, for what we consider speculators, speculation in the oil and gas industry. It is estimated the price at the pump between 10 and 20% of cost is a speculator. People like, you know, if you and I were speculators, we'd just be buying it, hoping, you know, some bad things happen in the world and the price goes up. We're not going to ever use it. We're not going to use it for anything other than the trade paper. We estimate 10 to 20%. The Commodities Trade Exchange or Commission has the capacity to hammer down on these people. And if you notice, in the last week or two, there's been a couple articles about some folks who were taking advantage of this, making millions. Well, that millions out of your pocket, your listener's pocket, your viewer's pocket, consumers. That's where they took it from. And all they were doing was trading paper. It wasn't like an airline company who speculates because they're trying to buy for the next 6 months so they can set their prices on airline tickets and they have their fuel then. It's the guy who just wants to make money off of misery. And that is where we need to curtail. So if you just think of that alone, you could knock off another 40, 80 cents a gallon. Just in that. That's what, when you look at speculation, it really, when the markets get hot, when there's problems in the Middle East or wherever else they're going on, speculators enter that market very aggressively and the prices go up. So those are a couple plays that you can do. But at the end of the day, we got to have an energy policy that gives us more flexibility and diversity of our energy resources. So when one price goes too high, you have something that can balance against it. When I was out in Quigg, they have 5 windmills ready to go. Ready to go. Problem? Some parts aren't there. And there's a long story behind it, which I learned.
I'll bet you
did. But the good news was, it wasn't the federal government. It was the state government. So I'm looking forward to that call.
All right. Senator Mark Begich is our guest as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska, and by Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
Well, this is fun. This is the first Talk of Alaska we have done with a live studio audience since the Conference of Alaskans with Frank Murkowski. We did a remote in Fairbanks, and it was all about the Permanent Fund. Mm-hmm. It's turning out to be all about energy. Senator Mark Begich, thank you,
thank you
for being with us on this program. And we have a studio audience with us and also callers. I want to get one caller in, just a comment really from Wendy, who says, please explain why ballistic missiles are still being emphasized in military defense when terrorism seems to be the real problem.
Well, it's a combo. It's not just one element. The war on terror, obviously, even with getting bin Laden, doesn't end. I mean, we have still issues all around the world. But we also have North Korea, which is not a very stable country, developing nuclear weapons. And the last defense line, missile defense, is Alaska, Fort Greeley. Also interesting to note, if Iran develops, which of course we believe they are, developing nuclear weapons, if they have the capacity to develop and launch, they can hit the East Coast. And a lot of people don't know this, but Fort Greeley is the last defense to the East Coast in missile defense. A lot of people think it was just North Korea. We have multiple opportunities on North Korea because the distance is shorter, but on the East Coast, when we've done everything, that's it. Fort Greeley is the last stand. And so in the world we live in, there is no single issue. War on terror is one, which is very mobile, also stationary as we know in Afghanistan, but more mobile, and you see it move as we put pressure in Afghanistan. It started to move to Yemen and some other areas, but we still have some countries that, they don't like us, and they're developing weapons that are very dangerous and actually developing at a much more rapid pace than most had anticipated. And so our missile defense system is really the last stand, and so it's critical.
478-TALK, 1-800-478-8255. Mark Begich is our guest. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk at APRN.org. And we have a studio audience here, and someone stepped to the podium. Would you introduce yourself and then ask your question?
My name is Sean Talbot. I'm a student at UAA and a commercial fisherman in Bristol Bay. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to ask a question on a different sort of resource.
What are you doing here instead of in Bristol Bay right now?
There we go. Senator Begich, how do you think Alaska should prioritize its natural resources in terms of corporate cash versus the preservation of rural Alaska and subsistence culture, specifically the dangers of pebble mine versus keeping around the salmon fishery in Nooshiegak Bay?
I don't know why I thought you were going to bring up Pebble Mine. I just had that feeling when you said Bristol Bay. First, let me say on the Bristol Bay, the general issue, first on Pebble Mine, then the broader, if I can do that. Pebble Mine, my position has been that we know there's still a long ways to go, but we got to be very careful not to swap off a non-renewable resource, mining, for a renewable resource, fishing. And when you think of Bristol Bay, it's an unbelievable rich fisheries. And when you think of where we stand in the United States and our fisheries, Alaska should be very proud of where we're at in the most sustainable fisheries in the country. And there's a reason. We didn't do it overnight. We did it over decades. And you, in order to continue to preserve that, you have to think about the long term. I think in the Pebble Mine issue, as you know, the EPA has entered the equation at this point, taking in all the information that both sides are put on the table. The most recent information I've gotten from the Pebble Mine Group, it's interesting, as soon as one side comes to see me in D.C., the other side, like in 2 days later, is already at the door. So it doesn't matter where, and I actually had to tell them both enough, you know, because what the problem is right now, it's a propaganda war. There's no permit pulled on this, so you have no process that is a formal process. So it's just who can buy the most media, who can buy the most lobbyists, who can scream about the issue the most. And on both sides, there's some solid information, and then there's some exaggerated solid information. And so what I'm hoping for now is the EPA, and both Senator Murkowski and I sent a letter very clearly to the EPA, don't prevent the process moving forward, but you need to be part of the process in deciphering all this information that's on the table. Pebble Mine folks have now said they're going to put all their environmental information on the table prior to their permit process, which I think is a good step. So we can actually see what it all entails. Now, on the broader sweep, the approach I've taken, and now I'm going to use fisheries as one example, and I learned this example when I was on the Anchorage Assembly and more so when I was mayor, the science component of all this is critical. You can have a lot of propaganda, a lot of politicking, but to give you an example, the North Pacific Fisheries Council, when they make a decision, we do not advocate to change that decision unless two things. One, a process issue has occurred, meaning that they didn't have public process, they didn't allow enough stakeholders, there something they didn't do in the process. We never will go in there and say change a decision, but we will say, you know, you didn't include these stakeholders, can you please do that? Or information changes that's pretty public that they need to at least reconsider. In the past, politics have always entered the equation. And they would, you know, something might be decided at North Pacific Fisheries Council, determining our sustainability. They based, you know, they do it based on science, stakeholder input. And some, you know, there's no fun in those. I mean, I would hate to be on that board, you know, because, you know, they get beat up from all sides. But once they make the decision, then my job is to ensure it moves forward. I think in the past what has happened is some politicians maybe didn't like the decision, so then they go try to manipulate the outcome. Well, then you're playing with science. And to be very frank with you, the last thing you want are politicians trying to now be scientists. The odds are we will mess things up significantly. So we made it a very clear policy when we came in. When it came to our natural resources, fisheries as an example, science has to be a significant player in this, and we should not interfere with that because we may have a different political view or opinion. And that's why I am anxious for this process to continue to move forward, and the EPA is going to lay some stuff out there. Feds actually have a very limited role here, which is very, a lot of people don't realize that. It's all state land, and BLM has a little bit of role, but EPA is the next. So my view is, got to be very careful swapping non-renewable for renewable. We got to get the permit process started so we can actually have these debates. But in the meantime, EPA is now entering it so we can actually start having a science discussion rather than a who bought the most TV today.
Go ahead. You going to follow up?
Yeah, there's a couple of concerns with this. I mean, first of all, it's there are obviously the two companies running Pebble Mine are foreign companies, which there's a lot of money to be made in Alaska from Pebble Mine. And truthfully, it's probably going to be a lot more than the fisheries are going to produce over the next couple of decades. Right. So I guess my question is, when the state looks at this and we're in kind of an economic slump and we need to, you know, boost our way out of it, you were talking about temporary fixing for the gas tax-free accounts. If everybody's going to be so up in arms about getting it done now and they want money now, how is the longer term going to play into that?
Yeah, no, your point is a good one, that self-interest and greed might take the place of rational thinking. Is that a
That's what I'm getting at, yeah.
Okay. Basically. I'm just summarizing, your thought there. This is where you have to have a long-term view of these resources. And I think, science will not dictate that policy in the sense of a short-term gain. It thinks of the long-term sustainability. And that's why I argue this point all the time. You have to always have the science as a major piece of the equation, because at the end of the day, that will look at the long-term. Even though maybe economically, you're right, if you just said, okay, business proposition A is fisheries, business proposition B is mining, over 20 years, 30 years, which one has the best economic return? Well, it's obvious. But if you then look at the generational aspects of it, there's a different picture there. Now, that doesn't mean you have to be against mining. You know, Donlin Creek is doing fine. Kensington Mine is doing very well. And it coexists with a lot of other, you think of Kensington, that coexists not only with fisheries and habitat issues, tourism, a lot of stuff. So it's a balance. And I think you cannot have the hard dollar overtake the long term. And that's a tough, and you know, I will tell you, the politicians sometimes want to see the short because they're thinking about today. People like me that are born and raised here, you know, an 8.5-year-old son, I'm thinking about the generational impact. And that's how we're approaching it.
I hope you share that with the rest of the Senate.
Oh, let me tell you, I share with a lot of people, and I share with the companies, and I share with both. When the groups come see me, how I say, like how we talk right now on the radio, how we may talk independently, that's how I tell them. There's no difference here.
Good. So. Thank you.
Let's try another caller from Palmer. Bill, welcome to Talk of Alaska with Senator Mark Begich. Thanks for hanging on.
Yes. I guess I can switch subjects here, try to be quick on time, but Medicare seems to be hitting it these days. And I want to make a couple comments and listen for a comment. Definition of terms here I'm using is medical industry, which includes pharmaceuticals. I'm also using the word pricing of a service or a product like a car dealer. And I'm also using the word cost as bare by those who purchase something. Excuse me. And I guess first comes up is those using Medicare seem to be blamed for this high cost when it's really the medical industry that sets the pricing for all of this. And the people I've been talking to have been telling me about this over and over. Why not say something about the medical industry who sets all these prices? And one of the things we notice is media, print and TV, you notice the commercials, and they buy advertising. So a magazine or a TV is not going to do a very critical analysis of medical industry costs, so on, because they're going to lose their advertising. And then, of course, there's the old political donations that the medical industry does. And I listen to these people telling me, I said, yeah, I guess you got it right there. And I guess it comes down to why is not the source of high prices, I'm not talking about that word cost, high prices, which are set by the medical industry, has never seemed to be on the table for discussion. It seems like it's just attacking the system. They want to attack the symptom, which seems to be Medicare. And I'm wondering about, is there ever any chance of medical industry at least getting down to the level of inflation? But Al Capone, he was pretty impressed with this years ago on the protection industry, but that's not it. Okay.
Bill, let me...
Great way to wind up, Bill. All yeah, right, thanks. And yeah. I understand you're gonna hang up and get your answer on the air. And thank you very much for that.
Thank you, Bill. Let me first say... Bill has a very good point on Medicare, and that is, I think there's a lot of people who say the Medicare system is broken because the users of the system, and it's a lot bigger than that. And first off, I think there were some plans that we saw come from the Republican-controlled House to really eliminate Medicare as we know it today. It would have devastated. In Alaska, for example, a patient today, Medicare costs are split 30-70%. 30% they pay through their co-pays and premiums and so forth, and the federal government pays 70%. In 10 years, the way the House majority had their bill lined out, it would have reversed. Medicare patients would be paying 70% of their costs, going from $5,000 to $10,000 a year. On top of that, an additional $3,500 for prescription drugs per year. An enormous burden on a fixed income senior, and no recognition of the Medicare system has to be revamped, especially on the delivery system, meaning the people who are providing the services. When we did the Affordable Health Care Act, one of the things we did is we went after a portion of that. We saved about $500 billion $500 billion out of Medicare by changing some of the delivery systems. Here's one example. Years ago, before I came along, and a lot of us were in the Senate, they passed a piece of legislation, a program called Medicare Advantage, which said the private sector can provide a certain program in Medicare, and the private sector sold it to Congress that they can do it at 95 cents on the dollar. Medicare pays a dollar, they can do it for 95 cents. Seemed like a pretty good deal. You could save a lot of money. Well, lo and behold, they nickel and dimed them all the way up, and now that same exact program costs $1.14 compared to a dollar in Medicare. And so we said, we're getting rid of that. In Alaska, only about 400 people picked that program up. Some other states, it was thousands. I think Alaskans figured it out, and we're much smarter about it than other states, but I'll leave that for someone else to judge. But we saved $500 billion, adding multiple years to Medicare. But the plan that was laid out by the House majority was to really eliminate it, as we know today, and turn it over to the insurance companies, which I don't know about you, but you know, I want to have my choice when I start taking Medicare, what doctors I want, where I'm going to go.
But what Bill's saying is, okay, that's one direction. You know, that's more deregulation, essentially. He's saying, well, how come regulation is always the dirty word in Washington?
Right.
And well, it still is. I mean, there's not the votes for any kind of increased regulation.
Well, I'll take Medicare. Here's some examples that I think have, you know, I supported reimportation of our drugs from countries that we have agreements with on quality, meaning we could probably lower the cost. Or in Medicare, it's the only one of the only programs we can't actually negotiate for our price of prescription drugs. I can do it at the VA. VA has an ability to negotiate with their providers of drugs. Because legislation years ago, the pharmaceutical industry, drug industry, was able to manipulate several senators, get a clause in there. And here's Medicare, that is a largest consumer of prescription drugs, in the sense of their clients, and we can negotiate. What will it save us if we could negotiate? $24 billion a year. So we are now looking at that as an option to help reform Medicare, that we should have the right, because it's not the fault of the patient when they don't get the right to negotiate. We gave away the right. So we have to be able to save, and that's a $24 billion issue. And I think these are efforts, and you're right, on regulatory ends, there's a lot of just deregulate everything and all will work out. While in Medicare, I guarantee you what will happen. Seniors will get less, they will be less healthy, insurance companies will make huge profits, and the system will break down. Right now, Medicare, to manage it, it's about 1.5%. That's what the federal government charges, which
is
nothing.
We're getting to wind up time here, and we got to take one more break as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Senator Mark Begich is our guest. We got just a few minutes remaining, and I want to throw it out to Homer and Doug. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Senator Begich.
Well, hello. Thank you. I enjoyed meeting you and Greer here at the coffee shop in Homer, Senator Begich.
Thank you. One of my town hall meetings. Thanks for being there.
Well, it was a pleasant meeting. I got an unpleasant experience fairly recently, as many people I'm sure have, at airport security. And I wish to put out as close to an official complaint as I can. I think most people are afraid to raise their voice because I think they're afraid to be put on a no-fly list, you know, that would be the thing that would happen. But I was subjected to both the See You Naked scanner and also what can really only be described as a sexual grope. And our country is better than that, Senator. We should be able to come up with something where we don't treat our people like that.
Thank you very much, Doug. And I have to give a lot of credit to Representative Sisna for really, you know, bringing to light what people were saying, but not saying, as Doug said, out loud. She did. She decided enough is enough. And my trip back here, we have actually TSA officials here. And we're going to have a meeting with folks to talk about, with some of the agencies, matter of fact, who deliver services to folks who have experienced sexual assault, abuse, disability, a variety of things. And the reason we're doing that is because TSA has to be more understanding and more sensitive. We know we have to keep, we have this new world we live in. You know, you probably remember the days when you could walk right onto the concourse, gate B, and there was people could meet you at the gate. You know, your friends and family would be right there, not at the doorway way down by the escalators. And I think, the world has changed quite a bit. But we have to have TSA recognize there's a level of dignity you have to provide as you deal with people, especially I don't know Doug personally, but think about individuals who maybe come from a background or a culture where touching one another is just not acceptable, period. And you end up in this situation where they're maybe coming through security for the first time. Maybe they're traveling. Maybe an elder from one of our villages has never been outside of the state and they're traveling in a secure environment. It's a whole different ball game. So we're having the TSA folks here at my request. We had good discussions back in D.C., but I said, you got to come to Alaska because you have to hear from Alaskans. And I think we can help them be a better agency. And they asked us to really assist them, which I think for Alaska is a great statement that we're part of the TSA debate nationwide and we have a chance to offer them an opportunity.
But you don't see any possibility of any kind of policy thing with the cracking down on TSA? from Congress?
I think TSA is under...
There's considerable...
Oh, they're under heat right now.
Yeah.
They're under heat. I think they recognize they have to manage their security differently than they are doing today. Because I think people are, you know, they've been very quiet for a long time. And now people are saying, okay, you know, time out. There has to be some sensitivity. I mean, I met with a parent with a disabled son who's in his 20s, but probably a mind age of around 7. And of course, she's been teaching him good touch, bad touch for years. Now, going through security, she's having to now explain what that means when a stranger may do a pat down. This was traumatic for this woman. She said for years, you know, she's been working with her son, who's now in his 20s, but has a mind of a 7-year-old. And so she doesn't know what to do. And that's a very good point. And TSA has had no training around this. And so they asked us, Alaska, to bring professionals together to work with them. And I think that's a great statement, because I think we have a lot of opportunity to help TSA become more sensitized to the process.
Anything else from the studio audience? Somebody want to step forward? We've got about a minute here.
Thank you, Senator. I'm just wondering if there's anything that you are doing with respect to the Alaska gas pipeline, and whether or not you think that pipeline is still an important issue for Alaska and the U.S. as a whole.
I'll be very quick on it. Gas line is important, not only for Alaska and jobs and economy and gas to Alaskans, because that's critical for long term, but it is number 5 on the list of green projects that the president has on his list. It's an important, and I've actually had a conversation with the White House and the president on this project. The federal government, we are ready. We have loan guarantees. We are ready to help streamline the permitting process. But to be very frank with you, the state needs to get off the dime and figure out what they're doing. I know they have a report coming out in July, but that's a very narrow focus. They did not look at all the options. You know, we hung our hat on one side of the equation so long. We better put all of them down and figure out. And the first priority has to be, no matter what we do, gas to Alaskans first, because we are in critical stage, especially here in South Central, Fairbanks. And then when you think of what's going on in rural Alaska, we have to have gas to Alaskans first priority. But someone needs to just pull the trigger and make a decision. And what, again, it seems like in politics, the better decision is not make a decision. The fact is, by not making a decision, you are deciding things which are not good for us. So strong supporter.
So you don't have a dog in this race. But still, you're in the U.S. Congress. But if you were running things in the state of Alaska, would you look for public investment?
I probably would.
Gas line going.
Yeah, because if you think of some of the great projects around the country, it's public investment infrastructure. And one thing about the pipeline, because it's regulated, you get a rate of return guaranteed.
Okay, we're out of time. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you very much. Great
Thank
option.
Thank you, members of the studio audience, John LaFournaise, Pat Yak, Ron Zastro, Josh Edge, Kristen Spock, and everybody else. Thank you very much.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news for over 26 years from Alaska's business sector, government, and industries. Information and subscription online at akbizmag.com. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.